Now we all run into conflict in our lives, and sometimes that can be a good thing. It pushes us to consider other viewpoints or be better people. But some disagreements run deeper when two people or two groups start seeing each other as the enemy. Talking across that divide can feel impossible. Our next guest has spent years studying high conflict, from bitter divorce proceedings to brutal decades-long civil wars, and says if we understand how it works, we'll have a better chance to turn down the temperature and have meaningful discussions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself in a disagreement with someone in your life that seemed like it had no way out? Did you find a way out? Have you found a productive way to talk with those you disagree with, personally or politically? Are there issues that you think people could find more common ground on if they talked with each other, but in the right way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author. Her latest book out now is called High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Can Get Out. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
When, Amanda, does a normal conflict, which can actually be good and healthy, turn into this high conflict?
Right. So conflict itself is not the enemy. It's when conflict distills into a kind of us versus them feud and eventually takes on a life of its own. And our brain behaves differently. We start making mistakes. We miss opportunities. And everything we do to try to end the conflict usually makes it worse. That's a sign that you're in high conflict.
You talk to a lot of people who've been in conflict or dealt with it in different ways. You learned some lessons in a couple different ways from a Gary Friedman, a lawyer who started working with divorce in a different way. And this is a really personal example of how high conflict can spiral out of control between two people. How did he tackle divorce differently?
You know, Gary was a traditional family law attorney, and he just found himself getting really dispirited with the way most legal proceedings leave everyone feeling a little worse, even the so-called winner. So he ended up, two friends of his who were getting divorced, a couple, they came to him and they said, this was years ago, and they said, could you help us through this divorce? And he said, well, I'd actually have to represent just one of you, and then someone else would have to represent the other. And he just started, you know, kind of parroting all the usual legalese. And they were upset and they said, why can't there be a way we can all work this out in a room together? And so he took a risk. He'd never done it before. At the time, it was pretty unheard of. And that's what he did. And they worked together for 4 months in this room, and it wasn't easy, but it wasn't two lawyers hashing it out while everybody else sat on the sidelines. It was the people who really owned the problem and understood what the solutions should be. And that became something we now call conflict mediation, which is a huge practice that is really outside the normal kind of us versus them arena of the legal system, the traditional legal system.
And there are a lot of lessons in this that apply to the other kinds of conflict you talk about. But starting with that core idea that, okay, going into this, you're adversaries. This is an adversarial relationship. And whether we're talking about divorce or politics or whatever, once you're on team A and I'm on team B, certain things start to happen. What happens then, Amanda?
You know, there's something about humans that once you sort us into two groups, it just brings out our worst conflict instincts. There's been a ton of research on this, but one example that I think is kind of fun to think about is conflict in outer space. So this is something NASA has looked at quite a bit because they want to do these deep space missions to Mars. So they really can't have dysfunctional conflict on a Mars mission, right? You need each other. You're in a confined space. It's stressful. So they've done these simulations of deep space missions, which are totally fascinating. And the longest simulation of a deep space mission to date, which was conducted in Moscow a few years ago, six men from four countries spent 17 months living in a small concrete building, pretending to go to Mars without sunrises or sunsets, with no real-time contact with friends or family. And each week they answered a survey about interpersonal conflicts. And there were 49 conflicts that they bothered to report. Presumably there were many more that didn't make the survey. And so one lesson NASA has learned is that you cannot pick a no-conflict crew. Crew members get distressed by bad news from home and take it out on one another. They have trouble sleeping, get on each other's nerves. You know, just like on Earth, there's unlimited sources of conflict in outer space. But here's the thing. There's one particular kind of conflict that's virtually guaranteed to happen, which is conflict between the crew and ground control down on Earth, right? So that's the power of the binary. Anytime you break humans into two groups, Democrats and Republicans, white, black, good, evil, crew, ground control, it tends to bring out instincts that make conflict less healthy. Not always, but usually. There's this one group here in space, my group, and that other one down on Earth, the other. So a lot of the astronauts' frustration gets redirected onto ground control. And in that particular Mars simulation, the crew reported 5 times as many conflicts with ground control as with each other.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley about her new book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Amanda, as you describe high conflict, it sounds overwhelming and scary, but a big point of your work is that even in the worst situations, it is possible to come out of it. And I want to look at maybe the most extreme situation in you present in the book, Sandra in Colombia, who's involved in this generations-long guerrilla, brutal guerrilla war in her country as a combatant. Can you share a little of her story and how she came out of this, what looked to me like an unsolvable conflict situation?
Right. Yeah. So I went to Colombia because I wanted to see what this country, I mean, this is a country for better and for worse that knows a ton about conflict, right? And they have spent many decades trying to get people to leave political, violent conflict. And many things they've tried have not worked, but some things have. And so for this project, I ended up spending time with Sandra, whom you mentioned, who, like a lot of people who entered Colombia's civil war, started out doing it as a young girl. So she was about 12 years old. She witnessed a neighbor of hers who was an elder who was respected get assassinated right in front of her eyes by gunmen who just pulled up and shot her. And it was very upsetting. And she'd been, you know, with her family on the run for many years because of the violence in Colombia. So she decided then and there to leave her family and join the FARC, which is the large guerrilla group in Colombia. And she spent years engaged in this high conflict. And then eventually, as have many thousands of other FARC members, left the conflict willingly, entering a demobilization and reintegration program run by the Colombian government. So it was not an easy process by any means, but what was really interesting for me was to see the patterns in her experience and how they connected with the other people I followed. You know, I followed a politician in California, a former gang leader in Chicago, an environmental activist in England. And in every case, including Sandra in Colombia, all these people were at some point trapped in high conflict, and they're not anymore. But they didn't stop fighting. They didn't suddenly change their mind. Sandra still fights for justice for the Colombian people, but they're much more effective in how they do it. So that was the interesting distinction for me that, you know, I came into this trying to figure out, looking for hope, you know, to understand how do people get out of really ugly conflicts, personal, political, all kinds of conflict. And what I found out was it's not about getting out of conflict. It's really about getting out of high conflict. And how does that happen? And how can you nudge people out of high conflict at scale?
And what is a first step toward that nudge?
One thing that's very important is to recognize saturation points. This is a point at which the conflict begins to feel too heavy to bear. And it's sort of like hitting bottom for an alcoholic, right? It's any kind of shock that happens to the conflict system. In gang violence, it could be as simple as a snowstorm. So there's a period of peace for 24 hours. Or it could be somebody dies or somebody gets shot, or in an ugly divorce, it could be a child gets sick. It's something that destabilizes the conflict temporarily. Now, this is where other people are really important. The people around you who are not in thrall to high conflict help you realize all that you've lost. So waiting for those moments, seizing those saturation points, it's very, very important. Like, timing matters a lot. And then once you do that, one of the things that's common to all those stories that I mentioned is that nobody I know who has left high conflict did it without distancing themselves from the conflict entrepreneurs in their lives.
Conflict entrepreneurs. Tell us who they are.
Those are the people, or sometimes companies, or sometimes media outlets or platforms that exploit conflict for profit in some cases, or attention or power. Often it's for meaning, a sense of purpose. But these are the people, sometimes they're in our, you know, regular life, the people who seem to sort of delight in every twist and turn the conflict takes, right? And I'm sure I've been a conflict entrepreneur at some point. As a journalist, it's very easy to do that. So realizing what's happening, who is benefiting from the conflict, because it's usually only the conflict entrepreneurs, and distancing yourself from those people or platforms or channels if you want to get out of high conflict. In the case of Curtis Toler, a former high-ranking gang leader I followed in Chicago, he literally moved across town. So he physically distanced himself. And then two things happened. First, people couldn't find him easily at first. And secondly, when his cousin was brutally murdered, he didn't know who did it, right? So it slowed down the conflict, which is key to getting out of high conflict. So he wasn't as interested in taking revenge and continuing that cycle because he had a little bit of distance.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley, author of the book High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found a way to bridge a formerly unbridgeable gap, personal or political, with people in your family, workplace, community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, field trips from New York to Michigan, conservatives and liberals getting together. What happens? We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Amanda Ripley, author of the new book, High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Amanda, I want to spend some time on the last chapter of your book, a really powerful story. A liberal synagogue congregation in New York, a conservative group of correctional officers in Michigan, and they end up doing mutual field trips and staying with each other. Can you tell us about that story? We could take some time on this one because it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's a really wild story. And it starts on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where there's a mega synagogue called B'nai Jeshurun. And it, over the century, has become one of the most influential Jewish communities in the United States. And a few years ago, this synagogue nearly came undone, torn apart by internal political controversy over Israel. And this is something that has happened in other synagogues. In this case, because of its influence and location, this controversy landed on the front page of the New York Times. It was very embarrassing for everyone involved. People started withholding their donations. Others threatened to leave the synagogue altogether. The rabbis were more left-leaning on Israel, and many of the congregants were more right-leaning, very protective of Israel. And this was a shock to the rabbis. The reaction was so sudden and volcanic. So they did what most of us do when we encounter sudden conflict within our own group, which is they really tried to make it go away and hope it never came back, right? Which generally, you know, unfortunately doesn't work, right? But they tried to apologize and move on. And then, of course, it flared up again a few months later over something else. Usually that kind of conflict, if you don't deal with it in a healthy way, just kind of ferments underground. So they ended up finally, after years of this kind of agony, deciding that they were going to do conflict differently. They were just going to literally spend a year going into conflict in a careful way instead of trying to avoid it. And they brought in some mediators who had worked on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and they had like hard conversations, and they tried to understand each other even as they totally disagreed. And it was really a massive investment in cultural change within this one institution, which most institutions don't want to do. Like they'll have a workshop, but they won't invest, you know, that amount of time in it. Anyway, they ended up getting to a place where they could, as the rabbi put it for me, tolerate the discomfort of someone else's opinion. So even as they disagreed, they felt like they understood each other better, which is like the key to the kingdom. Then when they came into another conflict, as inevitably happens in this case over whether the rabbis should perform interfaith marriages, they were able to do the same thing, to lean into the conflict, to have hard conversations, to really get into it and try to understand what's underneath it. Like, what is this conflict really about? Most conflicts are not about the things we talk about. They're about identity, fear, that kind of thing. And then this gets to your question. Finally, they, after Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, most of the people in the synagogue didn't know anyone who had voted for Trump. They were very distressed. So they didn't know how to lean into conflict because they didn't know anyone with whom they were in conflict with over this. So eventually they end up doing this exchange program with a group of Christian conservatives who live in rural Michigan and work at their local prisons as corrections officers, where literally the New Yorkers, the liberal New York Jews, come to Michigan and stay in the homes of the conservatives for 3 days. They have all kinds, they lean into the conflict again. They do things together. They go to a firing range. They eat Superman ice cream, which the New Yorkers have never had. And they have really difficult conversations. And this magical thing happens where they become curious about each other, which they weren't before they met each other. And then the Michigan conservatives came to New York City for 3 days, stayed in the apartments of the New Yorkers, went to the synagogue for services, visited Trump Tower, all kinds of things. And it wasn't like this kumbaya was there with them. It was very interesting to watch. It wasn't like a kumbaya, you know, moment of fantasy. It was much more interesting than that. You know, it was really interesting to see the things that surprised each other. It was sort of amazing how little they understood each other beforehand and how much affection they came to have for each other, even as they continued to like wildly disagree on many things.
And that's a key. They didn't try to persuade each other. They didn't, it doesn't sound like anybody really changed their politics at all, but they changed their understanding of each other's motivations.
Yeah, it's hard to explain because I think we've sort of lost that awareness that there is a third way. Like you can keep screaming at each other, right? Trying to persuade each other, which doesn't work. You can surrender or give in, right? Or which doesn't feel right, isn't right often. But there's another way, which is trying to understand each other even as you disagree. And what you find out is you get much more clear and accurate about where the disagreements actually are. And you're able to hold a lot more complexity in your head. So one of the women, Martha Acklesberg, who went from New York to Michigan, she told me, you know, that there was something about this trip that made her feel like the person she most wanted to be. You know, she was open. She was curious. She was also honest about expressing her own beliefs. She ended up hosting a Michigan conservative named Caleb Follett, who literally could not be more different from her in many ways. You know, he has an arsenal of guns in his home and he listens to, you know, he watches Fox News, and Martha is a liberal academic who started the Women's Studies Department at Smith College. There are differences in age and class and politics and religion, but they came to really have this incredible, obvious affection for each other. And she said to me, you know, I wish I could appear everywhere in my life the way I felt called to appear on this trip, present, open, able to be surprised. And I think that's the mark of good conflict, right? When you can disagree and still feel like the kind of person you want to be.
Let's bring on a caller. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hi. Wow, your guest almost said everything I was going to say. And that is that understanding means now I can do something I wasn't able to do before. Understanding begins with listening. I read a book called Getting More. He said, let's grow up, please. You can't have everything, but you can have more. I heard of a couple who said that the reason that they lived so long together was that they never hated each other at the same time. There was always somebody there to look out for the homestead.
Bill, thanks for that call. And Bill started with the listening there, Amanda, which is a key. Lessons for listening for us and maybe for us in the media while you're at it.
Yeah, you know, I did about 80 hours of conflict mediation training for this book, and I went into it a little bit overconfident. I thought I knew how to interview people because I'd done it for 20 years as a journalist, but it turned out that, you know, there's a difference between looking like you're listening, you know, nodding and smiling and furrowing your brow and laughing at the right moments. There's a difference between that and proving to someone that you are really trying to understand them, you know, which usually takes the form of listening and then playing back for them in the most elegant language you can muster the most important thing to them that you heard, and then checking to see if you got it right. It may sound sort of squishy, but there's actually a ton of really interesting research on this that shows that when you do this, when you prove, you demonstrate through actions that you have listened, even if you get it wrong, which you often do, right? And people say, no, that's not exactly right. People open up. The next thing they say tends to be less extreme and more interesting. People almost never feel heard, but it is often the thing they want most.
Amanda, in our last few moments, I mean, had I done the work that you'd done, I'm not sure if I would feel frightened for the future or hopeful for the future. Mm-hmm. Looking at the conflicts you've looked at, where do you end up falling?
Rob, that is like, it changes day by day. On the one hand, I feel much more hopeful because I have seen it. Like, I was skeptical of this idea that people could have good conflict. And I have now seen it in front of my face enough times that I know it's a real thing. I've seen people make that journey from high conflict to good conflict. So I know it can be done. I also know that we have set up a lot of our institutions, from politics to many journalistic outlets to social media, to incite high conflict. So we incentivize conflict entrepreneurs. Now, the good thing is we can change that. Like, we built those things and we can redesign them. But, you know, it starts with understanding high conflict and getting more sophisticated so we can fight smart, you know, because the truth is, whether we like it or not, as Americans, we are married to each other, right? Like, we can get divorced, but we have kids together. So we have to find a way to fight that leaves us with some sense of dignity.
Amanda, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Amanda Ripley, journalist and author. She was with us to talk about her newest book. It's called High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out.